Hello, friends. Welcome once again to the Perfect Bound Podcast. This is a podcast all about anything and everything comic books and comics related, brought to you by the Panel and Jumper and Comics Dungeon. My name is Ben. With me, as always, is Chris Casso.
Hello.
Nicole Lamb.
Hello.
And, of course, Mr. Cole Hornaday.
Hey.
How is everybody today?
Brilliant.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Cole's doing brilliant. How about you two?
Average.
Better as the night goes on.
Okay, good.
And tender is the night.
Ooh.
Oh, I just killed that one, didn't I?
It's more just me feigning, yeah. Like, I don't know what
that was something. There was something effervescent happening,
and
two things go through my mind when I hear the phrase tender as the night. One is the F. Scott Fitzgerald novel, mm-hmm. and the other is the song from the British band Blur. They have a song called Tender as the Night.
I think it's just called Joe Jackson. Isn't it Joe Jackson originally recorded the
song?
Well,
it's their own. I don't think it's a cover. It's their own song.
No, you're right. And I think he would probably cover it. I think it's a tune from the 50s. I could look at it on my phone if I cared.
Really need to know the answer.
Yeah. I know, right? Yeah. All right. Well, anyway.
I always sleep over this now.
As we're recording this, Emerald City Comic Con just wrapped up. And Nicole, you were there all weekend.
Yeah.
How
I'm
did
the only
it go?
One at this table
exactly.
who was there all weekend. It was great. I was both a participant and working the con. And so I got a little. Perspective of both.
A participant. What is that? Oh, because
like I was walking around.
Oh, okay, I got you.
Yeah, my shift ended and I walked around and my husband came from work and we walked around and stuff. Artist Alley had been moved up to the next floor, which made Artist Alley all one big unit, which it hadn't been before. It had been split up. The exhibitor hall was mapped out a little differently, so a lot of us back issue comic book stores were all sort of located in the same place, which was good if you were scouring for something you didn't have to walk the whole con and through the lines and everything like that.
And that's different from previous years?
Yeah, I think they just had stuff sort of scattered in different places. And it was kind of like the left of us was, after publishers, just sort of like a free-for-all. Mm. I couldn't quite get like what it was. There was like Funimation. Then there was like a big t-shirt place. But then there was like a little comic book place, but they mostly had toys. So I was just like, I don't know what's happening here.
Well, like Weta was there.
Yeah, Weta was there. Yeah. I mean, but they've been there before, I think. And they had an amazing, was it an orc?
Probably.
I think it was an orc.
Makes sense.
Do they have hair? Do they have hair? Usually?
Orcs? Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Then it was an orc. Yeah. And
it might have been a fighting Uruk-hai. Was it big and broad?
It was huge, but it had the orc face and he was dark.
Did he have
war
paint on him?
Yeah.
No,
was it slender or bulbous?
Yes. There you go.
He was a big meaty guy and he looked really scary.
Okay.
That's what I know.
Sounds like your generic orc tape person.
Anyway, Artist Alley was exceptional. I have like a whole splay of cards here of amazing people who have mostly webcomics and or are self-published.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't wait to like dig into their material and see it. I got to meet Brian Stelfreeze, who does the art for Black Panther, as well as Chris Sprouse. And it was very cute because Chris Sprouse is like, I hope I can measure up, Brian. And Brian's like, you do a great job, guy. So it was like super sweet. I had a great time both working the booth and being there. It seems like everyone is pretty happy with it from who I talked to.
Have they expanded every year? Are they like
pretty much?
Are they just constantly going to? Have they taken over the entire convention center yet?
I thought they pretty much did. Yeah. I mean, between the panels and the convention rooms that they have, they use like every floor space, the sky bridge, and every little nook and cranny usually has something going on. So.
Yeah. We were actually filming the Panel Jumper during Emerald City Comic Con, and I didn't even put it together that we had an actor running around as Batman while there were probably a dozen or two dozen other Batmans in the city.
Right,
there
that's why nobody honked at us.
Yeah, 200,000 Harley Quinns.
Right.
Oh, I can imagine.
Because you can buy your Harley Quinn at Hot Topic now, so.
Right.
Yeah.
I haven't been to Emerald City Comic Con in probably 3 years now. But I can safely say in the last 2 years, when people have asked me, why aren't you there? I'm like, because I'm doing my best to help shore up the culture. Because last year I was in tech for Puny Humans, a play about Emerald City Comic Con. And
where
this
you
time
played
around.
A comics dungeon manager.
Playing a character who is essentially based on myself. Yeah, there was a lot of meta stuff happening there. And this time around, Ben and I were working. working on, and dare I say it, our most ambitious episode ever.
It just, it looks so, like, so much fun. I wish I could have been around for the filming, but I have too many jobs.
Had weapons.
Yeah.
We had custom-made props. I can't wait.
We had...
Because we're going to have a fancy showing.
Yes, we are.
Soon? Yes.
We will be talking about that fancy
show. Oh, okay. Well, stay tuned, guys. Stay tuned, guys.
If you're
in the Seattle area.
I've got the press release right here, baby.
Anything else about Emerald City struck your fancy?
I mean, I always love Artist Alley, so that was the biggest thing for me. And just so many ladies and... just tons of talented people.
We did have cat signing.
Right. Yeah, Nathan Smith had Knack the Cat, and she was dressed as Archer again for the first one. Then she was dressed as Eleven from Stranger Things, and then she was dressed as whatever her name is from Firefly. I'm sorry, I don't...
Kaylee?
I don't the know mechanic? The people in Firefly. Yeah. Yeah, so she just looked kind of like a little toddler cat because it's like a flowery shirt.
And is she sitting there?
Yeah, she's just super chill.
Does she have a collar? Does she have a
No, she's just really...
He
says he uses Pavlovian training because cats do not take well to negative reinforcement. Uh-huh. So you have to constantly do positive reinforcement.
Right.
So that they just start learning the structures and things. And Nax, just a very chill lady. She's just super chill. She's always been that way. So it lends itself to being that way. But she was pretty tired. I think she napped like most of the time when she was there Sunday. Well, she's pretty much
Nicole,
half asleep.
She is a cat.
Well, Nathan kept making really cute jokes that, you know, he is taking some time out of her 21-hour sleep schedule. So, you know.
Right.
But people were freaking out. They were like, is that a real cat? And they were just like the sheer amount of joy and what other jubilation. Yeah, just... Sure. It was amazing.
It's really awesome when you are in a place where there's R2-D2, there's Chewbacca, there's a dozen Harley Quinns, but what gets everybody going was like, oh my God, it's a real cat!
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and also in the morning on Saturday, there was a parade of astromechs that blew my mind. Mm. The remote control astromechs. Yeah, wow. That was really amazing.
I saw a group shot. A friend of mine went to Emerald City, and basically all day yesterday just spammed my Facebook feed with all the pictures of the cosplayers that she took with their permission. They're like posing and smiling and all that.
Yeah.
She was posting them until yesterday, wasn't she?
Yeah.
There's just so many.
But there was a group shot where it's basically they gathered everybody who wore a Star Wars outfit. There's like a dozen stormtroopers and a couple of Chewbaccas. It was pretty funny seeing everybody.
Well, didn't there used to be
place.
Like the wasn't there? Didn't there used to be the 501st and their charitable organization, and they used to have a huge booth. And there's a photograph, and this is 10 years ago, maybe. Yeah, and there was this awesome Chewbacca walking around the floor, and Danny Chong took a picture of me, and this Chewbacca walked up. And the person in the outfit is actually wearing those individual stilts that the drywallers wear and had built this wonderful car that walks up, stops, pulls the head off, and it's a woman who's about 5'3".
That's cute.
And there's this great picture Denny took of me looking up at her because that was the best thing, was to have this woman, this normal-sized woman, as Chewbacca. I just thought that was the coolest thing
and
under
those,
the sun.
Those drywall stilts are not easy to walk in.
No way.
Yeah. There was a Pyramid Head from Silent Hill. Mm-hmm. It's Pyramid Head, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And he was posing, and he was on those stilts, too. Wow. And he was trying to, like, bounce. I mean, if you've seen a Pyramid Head, like, they've got huge
it's difficult
pyramid
to see through the head.
Heads. Yeah. Yeah. So it was pretty phenomenal.
So, Chris, how did it go for you holding down the fort here?
It was pretty busy. It was a little dead sometimes, a little busy other times.
Because we kept you busy for a little while shooting the panel jumper.
Yeah. But you gave me some Jameson, so that's all good.
Yeah. Don't let that get out.
Yes, we actually, it was Chris's birthday here when we were actually kept him late to film the panel jumper. So, as a thank you, we gave him a bottle of whiskey, even on a day when... He probably got up early to take care of the store for Emerald City. Any final thoughts on the con before we move on? What was your favorite? Do you have a favorite like cosplayer that you saw?
I saw Misty Knight, and she was just really excited that I knew who she was. And I got the cutest picture of her smiling. She's in Luke Cage.
Did she have a bionic arm?
But you haven't finished, have you?
I haven't started.
She did have a bionic arm.
Excellent.
And she had a gloriously big afro.
That's marvelous.
Yeah,
you got a picture with her?
I'll show you a picture later.
All right, I want to see that.
And if you want, I can send it to you. You could put it in the show notes.
Yeah, awesome.
Yeah, she was great.
Cool. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks. Thanks, Nicole and Chris and Cole. And moving on, because no thanks to me.
No, thank you.
Moving on. Last week, we talked about the Alien franchise. And then after that, Cole sent out this link about something we neglected to talk about, which was Neil Blomkamp's Alien movie.
Yeah, this kind of mystery project. It was like, 2 years ago, he started tweeting all these amazing.
Has it been that long?
I do believe. No. Yeah, I think it was 2014. Okay. Maybe it was 20. Definitely 2015. But there were like five or six of these amazing, and I think in that article you're pulling up there, Ben, you can link to them. Of these that made it look like it was going to be an immediate sequel to Aliens. Mm-hmm. And they were using images of Sigourney Weaver with illustrated. Alien-like body armor, you know, illustrated over her face. There was this image of his giant queen in clearly in a biodome, like, oh, maybe, you know, Weyland-Yutani is like breeding them. And, you know, so there were just enough images to spark your imagination in the best possible way and sort of like, you know, make up for all the disappointment that we suffered from Resurrection On. I would argue that in retrospect, did we not talk about this, that Alien 3 is actually not a bad movie when you look at it against Alien Resurrection.
It's like the progression you go through when you watch all of the Fantastic Four movies. Yes. The Roger Corman, and you're like, that's a terrible
movie. You know what?
Movie.
That one has the most charm out of the rest of this garbage. Yeah. And Alien 3 is terribly flawed and terribly, terribly disappointing in the way it was set up. But structurally, it's not a bad film in my mind. So,
and I did just like last night or the night before sat down and rewatch Alien versus Predator. And so, you're right. As you see those later ones, you're like, oh, Alien 3, I missed you.
I need to rewatch. I need to rewatch both the final two Alien movies. But the Neil Blomkamp movie was, it was greenlit because the art looked great and his script apparently is really great. But then Ridley Scott had to go and make Alien Covenant.
Then it was called Prometheus 2. Yeah, and so, have you guys seen the opening sequence?
Yeah, like the 4 or 5 minutes.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, which and it's a wonderful, it's a brilliant idea in just giving us that.
Yeah.
Because you meet all these characters, and I liked them all when we were done, and it pays such an incredibly deep homage to the first two movies. In fact, there's even an inside joke where the gal starts choking, and they riff on lines from the first one. And I was like, okay, you got me with this, gang. Do not break my heart again, Mr. Scott. Do not break my heart
again. Bring a little less God into this next movie.
Yeah,
please.
Well, no, I'm afraid that's going to happen, though. I think that's...
It's too late.
He's going to take all of his ideas that didn't get exercised, pardon the pun, and Prometheus.
I'll start lamenting when like they start previewing the toys and one of them's called like the Archbishop or something. Just
don't hold your. I think that's what's going to happen. So, but the Blomkamp film, you know, District 9, I thought was one of the best science fiction films in so long, and I don't know what that fella's deal is, but he cannot recapture the intelligence and the maturity of the filmmaking he demonstrated in District 9 because, gee whiz, everything he's made since then has just been really, really awful.
Maybe that's connected to the discussion we had earlier about Orson Welles and Citizen Kane, right? With District 9, maybe he had total and free control over what
possibly.
He was doing,
yeah.
Like Kane had with Citizen Kane. But it's really hard to re-catch that lightning in a bottle because now everybody wants a stake in what you're doing.
Right.
So he gets more money, but he gets more producers, and they all have a say.
Yeah, more cooks in the kitchen. That's entirely possible. Also, but see, my other feeling is that, or theory is that, you know, District 9 was based on a short film that he made, you know, on a shoestring budget. So I think there's something to be said for having had the ability to front load that sweat equity into a solid story and then expand it. That's my concern, is that he doesn't really have the creative impetus to create something new, or maybe he needs more time, or maybe I'm being really unfair, but these are the issues that came up around what would happen if this man got his hands on Alien. So
the Blomkamp movie isn't, it's, it, it's not currently happening.
No, but it has not been murdered. Shelved.
It's not right. been shelved. Right. Sigourney Weaver is connected to it. Yeah. She says that they will expect to do it, but they're not doing it anytime soon. They're both doing other things.
Yeah.
In the meantime, Prometheus 2 is coming up.
So. And I am hopeful where Prometheus 2 is concerned. I may live to regret that comment, but that's okay because they're just movies and it's not real.
All right. Well, be sure to make a sound bite out of that little segment.
It's just a movie says, and it's not real.
I may live to regret this.
Speaking of movies, Logan came out, and I've heard tell that it's not just a great superhero movie; it's a great movie. Has anybody seen Logan?
I'm going to go see it this week.
Yeah, no, none of us have seen it, so we can't comment on it.
I don't really need to talk about it. I just think
indeed,
it's interesting.
Everyone
that's
I've
all
to
I've heard.
Says
it's just amazing.
Customers say that it's fantastic. Yeah.
Nothing short of amazing.
Yeah, and it's another R-rated superhero movie. I think the industry might be moving. Towards that.
I think when it calls for it, why not?
Yeah. Right.
I don't think that Wolverines ever should have been like a kid's thing. I mean, besides like the cartoon, I guess, in the 90s. No. But, you know, he's got knives on his hand.
Right.
He's got knives for him.
And a feral aspect.
Yeah.
Right. Make Mine Marvel is going to relaunch with legacy numbers. How does that even mean?
What does that mean?
They're going back to original high numbers. So like,
okay.
So you're going to have like Thor seven number 700.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And right.
They must be coming across a milestone.
Yeah.
Mm.
What is this supposed to do? What is this supposed to do to sales? What is it?
I think it's kind of a belated like, oh, we're sorry for all you people complaining that you hate that there's like 20 number ones for Captain America. Which, true. I do like the idea of one consistent set of numbering. But they're treating this as if it's a number. It's another relaunch. So that's your problem. It's like your fourth relaunch in 3 years.
Mm, at least.
Right. So it's just sort of like little too late.
Also, it's confusing because case in point at ECC, there was the Old Man Logan. That Mark Millar did, it collects a certain number because it was like in a certain amount of the Wolverine run, which isn't
through 60 something.
Yeah, which isn't necessarily combined with this thing, but people were like, "Oh, this cult clearly isn't the whole run." So it is, but like it's confusing to people. Yeah, you have like five number ones, that's confusing. You go, "Oh, it's 603." Everyone's like, "Oh, well, I can't start this because it's 603. Yeah. So I think they're just not quite solving the problem by doing that if that's the case.
Best current example is Rebirth relaunch Detective Comics.
Yeah.
And it's doing really well. It's got a great creative team and everything. But it started at like 891, 892.
I think in the 900s or something. But whatever,
something
either
like
way, yeah.
And so the problem is when people now ask me, oh, where do I get the first issue? Now everybody has to remember it's 891
yeah, see, then we can't remember.
Which we can't do, obviously.
Yeah. Yeah.
So when you go by a system like that and you just suddenly drop people back into a high number, it just makes it a little tricky.
So the weird thing is, and this is an article from I got from bleedingcool.com, it says, all the old school legacy characters will return with issue numbers that will add up all the issues published of that character central series so far, including all the relaunches. So does that mean
there's
going to be a big gap in the numbering?
Yeah, that's what that sounds like.
Yep, that's because they've already kind of done that with, I think Deadpool had a number 900, and they just counted like everything that ever had his name on there to get to that number. So it's just sort of like, yeah, okay, I guess that counts.
The article is kind of snarky. Well, it's bleeding cool. The guy says, if anyone wants to work out what issue number all these books should be, well, you'll do a better job than Marvel usually do when they try.
Well, can't say they're wrong.
Nope.
And one of our favorite properties, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, is going to be rebooted as a 2D cartoon soon. We're happy about that, aren't we, Cole?
Yes, we are. Yeah. And I think I posted on the Facebook is that this... In introducing this new era of Ninja Turtles 3D to new audience, that just supports the whole discussion I had in the episode that we shot. That it's this lovely property that is incredibly portable, and it's just going to keep. I'm not going to say recycling because I think it's kind of derogatory where the turtles are concerned, but it can be molded to fit the sensibilities of another age group. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be another group of kids what, we're talking third generation now that are, I mean, there's never not been a Ninja Turtles animated series on TV, but these ones are going to be reaching, I think, a third generation.
It's on Nickelodeon, so yeah. I think that's the demographic.
Right, right. Well, Nickelodeon bought the Ninja Turtles from Eastman and Laird, remember? We talk about it in the episode. Edited that.
We didn't
there's
say
already been an animated series, like, currently, so.
It's a CGI series.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is why all the adults in the room are cheering, because now it's going to probably, I mean, the picture on the news article is like a still from the old cartoon.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So who knows how closely it's going to resemble it.
Right.
But like to your point, Cole, a quote from the president of the Nickelodeon group, Sama Zaragami, says, quote, "The Turtles is a property that has reinvention in its DNA."
I love that.
Which keeps it fresh and relevant to every new generation.
It was like, satisfying
demands of adult fans.
I wish I'd written that. That was a great quote.
That is like a brilliantly corporate thing to say.
Yeah, it is. Well,
I think it's actually fourth generation.
Oh, you could be right. Yeah. You're right. We just said that they had divested controlling interest. We didn't say that they sold to Nickelodeon.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm. Are you going to say something, Nicole?
Mm.
No, sorry.
All right. And finally in the news today, former Vertigo executive director Shelley Bond has been hired by IDW to launch a new creator-owned imprint titled Black Crown. The reason I brought this up is because I thought IDW was creator-owned.
It has
is
elements
it one of, the...
of it. They, both okay. them and Dark Horse. So the reason this was interesting is because we haven't talked about it on the podcast, but so Shelley Bond worked for Vertigo soon after it was founded, but it was founded by Karen Berger.
Mm-hmm.
And Karen Berger just made an announcement mm-hmm. like a month mm-hmm. ago that she's going to Dark Horse and mm-hmm. she's doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So she's doing it before Shelley Bond. So now it's almost like, it's a very interesting competition. It's like Vertigo just got divided. Two of the more important aspects of Vertigo just got taken over by these two companies that are rising, you know.
And meanwhile, is Vertigo at DC even worth discussing anymore?
No.
That's really sad. I never understood why they you know, broke up that party. I just don't, because there was great stuff coming out of it.
Just bad management.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, look at New 52.
Right.
But so yeah, I think it's very interesting. Shelley Bond, she worked under Karen Berger, and they're both like big driving forces with a lot of people respecting them. So it was just really funny. It's just sort of like, I don't think this is a case of like somebody copying the other one, but it's, I wonder how much like IDW was like scrambling, like, well, we need to get somebody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my understanding is that in Berger's case, her non-compete clause in her contract and Vertigo was up, yeah. so she could go do what she was best at another publisher. Mm-hmm. But Bond has been gone from Vertigo for a lot longer. Is that right? Or do you think it's a similar circumstance?
I actually thought it was the other way around, but now I'd have to research my brain.
No, I think you're right. Yeah,
because I just thought Bond was a little bit more recent. Berger was maybe. Mm. Years back.
Yeah, she was the glory days in the 90s, wasn't she? She didn't. Yeah. She wasn't there into the 21st century.
That's what I thought.
Okay. Yeah. I don't remember.
Hopefully, having more creator-owned opportunities for people will give them opportunities to put, you know, great material out. I mean, just seeing, again, going back to the ECC thing, mm-hmm. seeing so many people who do either self-published mm-hmm. work and or web comics, and they want to have like printed material to have in stores,
right.
they might have an opportunity now through these new channels opening up with some people who are very strong from the industry.
I kind of view their roles as not only like very strong filters as to what's coming in, but also as kind of like talent scouts.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that's what makes me very hopeful, because I've been thinking Dark Horse really needed to do something soon so that they're not dependent entirely on franchises
mm-hmm.
and Hellboy.
Yeah. also Hellboy and Buffy.
Right. You know, so it's just like, you just kind of get back so that you're not just under Mike Mignola and Frank Miller as the two names most people associate anymore.
Because mm-hmm.
They did have a lot of other names, but it's not like Concrete's coming out that often. It's not like Grendel's doing anything.
Yeah.
No.
So everything that Dark Horse was really known for through the late 80s through the early 90s, like, Hellboy's the only one going strong.
Yeah, and they do such great collections at usually like pretty good prices too, so they could, you know, really be competition if they've got that content coming out.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Cool.
Good.
All right. Well, that is the news for this week. If we didn't cover something you wanted us to talk about, tell us at perfectbombpodcast@gmail.com. Now let's move on to Book Report, everybody. And this week, Cole Hornaday, let's start with you. What do you want to tell us about?
I want to talk about, speaking of Hellboy, I want to talk about The Visitor, How and Why He Stayed by Mike Mignola and Paul Grist. Paul Grist was a perfect artist for this, and I will tell you why in a bit. The Visitor is an alien character from Hellboy, from one of the earlier stories, I think from Seed of Destruction.
From the very first?
Yeah. I don't really remember if he was part of an invasion force or I think he was just a visitor, but for some reason he got into conflict with Hellboy. Do you remember the story?
Can you recall, Nicole?
Did you read those recently?
I just read The Seed of Destruction. Yeah. So okay. He just shows up for a minute and they're like, hey, look, stuff and things. And then that's it. Yeah.
Because I don't know if he's in the second arc after that.
Recall that.
I tell you what, my only association with this alien or this visitor character right now is that I am one of the rare people in the Western Hemisphere that has the action figure.
Ooh.
I didn't realize how scarce that freaking thing was until I looked it up the other day. So he's been sitting on my shelf collecting dust for a very, very long time, and I love him, and these are the figures that were designed to look like Mignola's work. So I don't really remember what his story is, and that's cool because this series is going to be a five-parter, is basically him observing the life of Hellboy from a distance. Mm. So it's kind of a cliff notes on Hellboy's life, but it's a little bit like, The Martian Manhunter, where he's observing, he can mimic humans, he's trying to figure out how humanity works, but I don't get the feeling there's anything malicious about him. Mm-hmm. As I said earlier, Paul Grist, who was known for Jack Staff and Burglar Bill and whatever, Kane, he's an independent publisher from the UK who every once in a while gets his work over here. He's a perfect artist for this series. He's got a very cartoony, heavy inking style, not quite as heavy as Mignola, in fact, much thinner drawing style, but is a perfect... a follow-up artist to dabble in the Hellboy storytelling. And the book feels a little nostalgic, and it's also fresh at the same time. I'm going to stick with it. If you're a Hellboy fan, you'll be very, very pleased because, I was wondering if Hellboy was just going to be gone from the whole Dark Horse publishing realm when he died or when Mignola said he doesn't live anymore. However that works.
And the art is really, really good in it.
It is really beautiful. Yeah. And the colors, I think it's Chris Roberson did the colors. Mignola and Roberson wrote the story. It's all Paul Grist on the art, and it's Bill Crabtree on the colors. Mm-hmm. I recommend.
All right, cool. The Visitor, How and Why He Stayed. Thank you, Cole. You held it up for me so I could read the title. All right.
Number one of five.
Number one of five from Dark Horse. Nicole, what do you got for us?
I read a IDW Deviations of My Little Pony, Friendship is Magic, because there are angry little puppies in here, and I had to read it. So they went to Katie Cook, who's been writing My Little Pony for a long time, and they said, you can take the ponies, and you can do any story that you want at all. And there is, the most awful pony called Prince Blueblood. And he is the most narcissistic pony ever. Celestia decides to take him under her wing and try to teach him some things. So she sends him off to Ponyville, and Princess Luna shows up, and she's like, the night will be yours forever! And she's like trying to like take over everybody, but she's doing it all wrong because she's kind of a villain, but she means well because she just wants people to like the night. And like the whole time, like everyone's like, okay, you're here to help us, Bluebud. And he's like, no, not really. I just want to wear this cashmere scarf, and can you like get me some lattes, and can you like file my nails and stuff like that? Like he's just being such a little jerk. And so everyone is just like just getting mad at him and mad at him. He's got this cute little puppy dog named Bunny, who's pretty much just like an angry Pomeranian. But he even makes Bunny mad at him because they finally just send him to the moon. Even Princess Luna doesn't want to deal with him. Like everything's just stops. And they're like, wow, we hate this guy so much. And he gets thrown onto the moon and Bunny's there. And there's just one panel where he's sitting on Cole, you got to look at this. He's sitting
on
the moon, and he's a shade of blue.
Yes.
It's a Dr. Manhattan Watchman.
With the pink surface.
With the pink surface.
Yeah.
It's so funny. That's what we saw last night, and I was like, what is going on in this comic?
Nice.
And the dog, you know, the blue blood is like, okay, well, now we're just going to, like, make a little village here on the moon, and Bunny's doing all this work, and he spells out help out of like, all these buildings that he's making out of dirt. And Celestia sees it, and she goes running up there, and he's just got, like, his own little world going on there, and he's like, I've got friendship, see? I've made these little clay people. And Celestia's just like, oh, God, there's just no hope for this guy. And that's it, and that's the whole story. And it's really, really fun and really great, and he's just terrible. He's absolutely horrible. But you get a little smattering of a bunch of the main ponies. You get Celestia, you get Luna, which are the princesses of the sun and the moon. And so I think if you've never read a pony thing, you could just totally jump into this and have a good time with it. And Chris looks like he's chomping at the bit to add something to this for some reason.
So it's worth mentioning what Deviation is.
Oh, yes, it does. Yeah. Yeah. Go ahead.
Oh, okay.
It's you.
So IDW does this thing with all of its properties where they do one-shots where they're like, what if something changed in history? So for X-Files, it's what if Mulder was kidnapped instead of his sister? And so his sister is in the FBI.
Oh, interesting.
And then for Ghostbusters, it's like, what if they failed and the Stay Puft Marshmallow took over the world? For Transformers, it's like, what if Optimus didn't die, you know, during the movie?
Do they all have bad outcomes like old school Marvel What If did?
Usually
like,
they...
You got the best possible scenario here, folks, but, you know, when Spider-Man joined the Fantastic Four, it all ends in tears, that kind
of
thing.
Yeah, most of them are kind of like cautionary tales.
Got it.
So the Deviations are kind of funny, and the fact that they did one for ponies, I saw in the order form, I'm like, I just need to know what they're going to do.
Yeah. So, yeah, it was great. I mean, just giving people the reins to just play and do whatever they want, I think, is kind of a treat to the writers.
Yeah.
To be able to just play with that. So, yeah, it was really fun. It's a $5 one-shot. Katie Cook is writing it, and who's doing the art? I can't see the credits. Garbowska?
All right. Grabowski.
Yeah.
Is Katie Cook a normal My Little Ponies author?
Yeah, and she also did a webcomic called Gronk that's really cute. It's a monster who doesn't want to live in, like, the monster land and just comes and, like, lives with some girl, like Garfield, kind of, you know, except with monsters. Yeah, it's really cute. And people are usually pretty big fans of Katie Cook if they're My Little Pony fans.
Cool.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
My Little Pony Deviation from IDW. Thanks, Nicole.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, Chris Cassell, what do you got for us?
I read the first issue of Heathen from Vault, which is a new publisher, and it was a Kickstarter, so it's nice to see they got picked up by a publisher. It's written and drawn by Natasha Altarici, it's a Viking story, and it recounts the story of the creation of the Valkyries, and specifically... Brynhilde. They change names slightly in here, and they go with Brynhild, and how she disobeyed Odin and killed somebody that she wasn't supposed to kill, and so he wants her to marry as punishment, and she's like, okay, fine. She has to be marry a mortal and live out her endless days in exile. And her condition was, I get to choose the mortal. So that's the end of the legend. She's still waiting for a worthy mortal. And so the main story follows a young woman who's been banished from her village, or actually she kind of snuck away because she kissed a girl. And both of their parents were given the decision to either murder their daughter or marry her off so that she would, you know, be fixed. So the other girl...
Be purified.
Yep. The other girl, her father chose to marry her off, and so she's about to leave. The main character, she, her father decided death, but he really just kind of snuck her out of the village.
Mm-hmm.
And so, knowing the the myth of Brynhild, she decides to go and be the mortal. So she's on a quest to be worthy, and she steals a horse named Saga, and that's going to be her best friend through the story. And the gods pay attention to it because they're used to their cycles repeating and being very similar. And this one trickster god named Ruadan, who's pretty much Loki, he's pretty much like, oh, this is going to be good. This is different. So yeah, it's an interesting first issue. It's got really nice artwork. I'm looking forward to seeing what she can do with it.
So Vault is pretty new publishing company, right? Yep. Have you reviewed some of their books before? I don't remember.
No, I think
Nicole, didn't you? No,
not that I can recall.
Okay. I think this is one of their second or third release in like a 3 month period.
Okay,
so they're like fresh new.
Is that their thing where they go through and they buy up Kickstarters?
I don't think so. This is the only one, but this is the only one I'm familiar with.
Okay.
I just remember seeing that and then like going to her website and being like, ooh, maybe I could get some of her art books, because she did some like dinosaur artwork as well. So yeah, I like it.
Alrighty, cool. Heathen by Vault, or From Vault.
From Vault.
By Alterici and Deering. Alright, cool. Thanks, Chris. And that is Bookport, and that is our show, and coming up is quiz time. But before we go, I want to do two things. I want to tell you that the Perfect Bound Podcast is brought to you by The Panel Jumper. See everything Cole Hornaday and I do at thepaneljumper.com, and by Comics Dungeon here at 319 Northeast 45th Street in beautiful downtown Wallingford, or 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at comicsdungeon.com. Subscribe to us at iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts at perfectboundpodcast.com. Send us an email, perfectboundpodcast@gmail.com. And the second thing I want to tell you about is in 1 month from today, on April 14th, 2017, we're going to have a special live event of the Panel Jumper Chapter 4. Go ahead and tell us all about it, Cole.
Yeah, we are rounding the bend to Chapter 4 of the Panel Jumper Live. That's going to be April 14th, 8 p.m. at West of Lennon. Shall I tell them about... Tell the good people what they can look forward to seeing.
Please do.
We have a very special music guest, Kyle Stevens, better known internationally as the internationally recognized singer-songwriter Kirby Crackle.
He's big in Canada.
Yeah, he's big all over. Director, playwright Andrew Shanks, recent winner of Ghostlight Theatrical's Battle of the Bards 11, has written a newly commissioned play for us called Man in Suit, which explores the life of Daikaiju actors. Sketchfest Seattle headliners and Best of Fest trio Dayjob will share their inimitable brand of physical comedy, heartwarmingly bizarre interactions, and pigeons. I don't know what the pigeon thing is. It's in their press release.
You should come see the show.
Yeah, in case there, because there might be pigeons. There might be pigeons. And we have, as I have mentioned earlier, our most ambitious Panel Jumper episode ever. You want to speak to that, Ben?
Well, what we did is we're talking about the phone campaign to kill off Jason Todd.
The death of Jason Todd by 1-900 number.
So this is going to be a special episode where we're going to show you Act 1.
Mm-hmm.
And not to give anything away, but to give everything away. Yes. At the end of Act 1, Manager Mike and his nephew Steve are taken hostage by a couple people. Batman is winging his way to the comic book store, and the audience is going to decide if Manager Mike and nephew Steve live or die.
So you have to be present to participate in this, in the climax of this story, whether Manager Mike and nephew Steve are going to live or whether they are going to suffer the consequences.
We're filming both outcomes. We're going to show whichever outcome wins the vote count at the end or in the second act of the show. And the other thing we have is another live recording of the Perfect Bound Podcast.
Right. And we will be joined by a very, very special industry guest, Tatiana Gill.
Yeah.
Tatiana Gill, Seattle-based cartoonist, illustrator, and teacher whose work delves into feminism and body positivity. If you follow us, follow the Panel Jumper on Facebook, today I did this, but you're not going to know about this for a couple of days, or weeks, rather. I'm going to start regularly posting Tatiana's illustrations because I love them so very, very much. She does plus-size renditions of characters like Marvel's Dazzler and Wonder Woman, and they are I can only say exquisite because they are just sensual and lovely, and they make me happy to look at them. So I said, can I keep posting images that you've drawn? She's like, yes, you can. I am so excited to have her on the show. I am so happy that she said yes. Yeah, we'll be doing a live Perfect Bound podcast that she will join us on, and we are going to round out the show with what? Some burlesque by the lovely Café Ale. Café Ale Ole.
I like that name.
Café Ale Ole. Right. And she is take us, a little hint on what her theme of her burlesque is going to be. She's going to take us where no one has gone before.
Awesome. So, Friday, April 14th, 8 p.m., west of Lynn. And check us out. Thepaneljumper.com will have information there. Thank you for sticking through that. That's the closest thing we get to an advertisement here on the show.
Yep.
And now it's quiz time. Get your quiz hats on, everybody. And this week, the questions come to us from me. I saw an article where it talked about superheroes who don't wear superhero outfits, and it was kind of lame.
Are you going to say they don't wear pants? I'm like, no. Well, that's quite a few of them, actually.
So I came up with comic book characters who don't wear clothes.
Okay.
Clothes at all. You're probably going to get all these because it's kind of obvious. Number one.
Because they're naked-y.
This humanoid plant elemental creature first made his naked debut in House of Secrets 92 from 1971. Say it out loud, everybody.
Swamp thing.
Number two. Sometimes drawn with metallic short shorts, you know this herald of a planet eater prefers to go au naturel as he hangs 10 through space.
Silver Surfer.
Yeah. Number three, Howard the Duck often complains of being trapped in a world of hairless apes, but was introduced in the panels of this comic, of the comics of this clothesless monster.
Man thing.
Number four, chances are nothing would fit this oversized character, which is good since he has most recently found himself in hell where clothes would be ill-advised.
Would that be Hellboy?
No, that would be Godzilla.
Oh!
Godzilla in hell.
Yeah.
Hellboy wears clothes.
Well, but you know, I thought you were doing a fast and loose there with Bernie's clothes off. You know, my mind goes to the worst places.
And finally, this...
Ben, it's Godzilla.
It is Godzilla.
Yeah.
Finally, this character's costume started out as a sort of black leotard, which presumably he created. As time progressed, the costume shrank progressively to a pair of shorts, then a Speedo, then a thong, then completely naked. He would eventually go on to wear nothing at all because he could not comprehend the need for clothing. His original costume was only created because it made those around him, including the general public, more comfortable.
Dr. Manhattan.
It is Dr. Manhattan.
Yep.
All right. Well, that is quiz time, and that is our show. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next week.